This program is brought to you by Fine Diners Over 40, a members-only dinner club for singles and couples who enjoy dining at highly rated restaurants and sharing the experience with others. Learn more at finediners over40.com. That's finediners over40.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. And back with me this week
is Caitlin.
Is Caitlin, my wife, and I still need a name for this, whatever we call the intro co-host.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great.
Yeah. Were you jealous last week that I did the intro with Mike Trout at the Philly Chef Conference?
I wasn't jealous. I actually thought he did a good job.
He did do a good job.
Yeah.
And you were probably, let's be honest, you were probably glad that I didn't have to wrangle you into the office to do this.
Let's be honest. I was probably asleep.
Whenever it was that we would have done it.
Exactly. Whenever it was.
So this week, Caitlin, I feel like I should almost turn this over to you because the guest is Aisha Nerjaya. Aisha is the chef of Shuka Restaurant, which is in downtown Manhattan. It is walking distance from your office. As I'm saying this, you're kind of like chomping.
I'm so excited.
You're chomping at the bit. You had never met Aisha.
I had never met her.
How often do you go to Shuka?
There was a while. I'm not even kidding. I was going like twice a week.
Twice a week.
Yeah. It's about a 10-minute walk. And I would get the exact same thing. I was such a regular that they started sending me things. But I would get the same thing. I would get the fried halloumi.
What is that?
It's basically cubes of fried cheese. Uh-huh. No, really, what could be better? Nothing. Then I would get the falafel. She does this incredible falafel.
Uh-huh.
And then the chicken shawarma, which we've actually tried. We've had together.
Yeah.
And it's so good. It's the kind of dishes that you have and you think about for days, and then you have to go back and have it again.
But not fussy, complicated, not overwrought.
No, it's not. It feels
healthful. It's kind of Middle Eastern / Mediterranean, as she likes to say. It feels very healthful. It's the kind of food that's having a moment right now. As listeners know, I was just in Philly, and I went to a couple of Mike Solomonov's restaurants, including Zahav, which is in a similar vein. I mean,
her food is bright.
Yeah.
That's how I would describe it. It's bright.
It's light.
It's light. It's really flavorful.
Yeah.
But it's kind of addictive.
Yeah. So this interview, I need to say, I recorded this interview in January. Aisha's probably sitting around going, where the hell is my interview? To be honest, I was banking a lot of interviews because I was going to be on book tour. I also had just interviewed that same week Hillary Sterling, who is another chef in the same restaurant group. I don't even know if the restaurant group has a name, which I'm embarrassed because I've known the owners forever. But Vicky Freeman and Mark Meyer, Vicky's a restaurateur, Mark's a chef. They've been partners for years. They're married. They also have had a restaurant group for years. They have Cook Shop, Rosie's, Vic's, where Hillary is the chef. Shuka, which used to be 100 Acres. And I just thought I should put a little distance between the two interviews because they are in the same group. It just happened to be a coincidence that I interviewed them 2 days apart.
Mm.
So I've been sitting on this knowing I had it kind of in my pocket. And Aisha, I'm sorry it took me so long. I probably could have gotten it up sooner. But anyway, here it is. I think this is a great interview. Aisha is a total... Well, you did better for the first time that day. You and I went into lunch. She's a quintessentially New York personality.
Mm-hmm.
She's very confident. She's got strong opinions. She's unshy in her voice. She's endlessly curious, as people are going to hear in this interview, about food. And also, unlike most contemporary chefs I know, she's traveled a lot. But when she goes to different places in the world, She does not have a punch list of hot restaurants. She finds a way to get into people's home kitchens. That makes sense to you, right? Eating her food.
Yeah, that makes complete sense.
She learns about food from home cooks.
Yeah.
In different regions of the world.
And she loves it. I mean, that's the thing. That's what you pick up when you eat her food, but also from this interview. She loves what she does.
Yeah, she really does. So I don't think I'm going to say anything else. I think I'm going to jump right in. Here you go, everybody. This is my interview with Aisha Nerjaya, recorded at Shuka Restaurant early in the morning. We had to make coffee. We all needed coffee. So the first thing we do, you don't listen to us make the coffee, but it was that early. And recorded early in the morning at Shuka Restaurant back in January. Here you go. I hope you enjoy it. It's gonna take a I've never been in this restaurant in the morning. It seems like it's a great place to come to in the morning. The light goes through from one end to the other.
Yes, it's beautiful. It's actually the nicest because it's so quiet.
And it's quiet. I mean, it's a quiet part of town anyway.
3 years ago, 100 Acres used to do breakfast.
Uh-huh. But I didn't know that.
It was just quiet.
What kind of breakfast did you guys do?
It was like before my time.
Okay.
It was probably like the Southern breakfast stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I think it was too quiet, so it kind of phased its way out.
All these places that have done breakfast over the years that can't sustain it. When I lived in Carroll Gardens, Prime Meats did breakfast, and I lived a block away, and it was heaven. But one of the reasons it was heaven is I was the only one in there, so I guess that didn't make sense. Well, tell our listeners, for people who don't know Shuka, how do you explain what you do here?
So Shuka is a Mediterranean, Middle Eastern restaurant. And uh-huh. I like to say that because I think that people hear Middle Eastern and they're like, oh, I don't want to try that stuff, or there's not something on there for me. But I think the way that the menu is designed, that it takes inspiration from a lot of places.
Yeah.
So whether you're an adventurous eater or someone that likes to be on the safe side, there's something for everyone.
Is that how you go about writing a menu? Do you think in those terms?
Sometimes.
A balance of sort of familiar and then maybe stuff that might either be there for people in the know or for people who are a little more adventurous and want to get turned on to things?
I think that the Shuka was the first time that I probably did that.
Yeah.
Because I think it's important for Mark and Vicky to have restaurants that are accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. And we wanted this to be a neighborhood place, somewhere where people can come here multiple times a week if they wanted to.
Yeah.
So the choice of variety plus, I guess, the easy accessibility of that was just a combination for the menu development.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think I told you this one. We just met for the first time when I came into lunch a few weeks ago.
Yes.
But I was with my wife who works nearby. She works for Scholastic over on Broadway. And she comes here all the time. She loves this restaurant.
Thank you.
She
That's awesome.
Loves this restaurant. She's one of those people. So tell me, what's your connection to this food?
So I think that in every chef's life, you start off as a cook where you're cooking someone else's food, and then you move up the ranks and the brigade. And then you come to a point where you want to cook what you want to eat.
Yeah.
And that's really how Shuka was developed.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came here, it was Southern American.
This was 100 Acres.
This was 100 Acres.
And this space, for people who know downtown New York, for years was a restaurant called Provence.
Yes.
And then Vicky Freeman and Mark Meyer, who you just mentioned, who also own Vic's and Cook Shop and some other restaurants.
Rosie's.
Took over the restaurant. They had loved the restaurant Provence. Then they turned it into this southern experiment you just described called 100 Acres. You came into that somewhere along its lifespan.
Yes.
And from there.
So when I met them, they said, you know, we're looking for a chef at 100 Acres. And I was perplexed because Missy had set up the meeting.
Missy Robbins,
who I worked for at Avoce. And for the better part of my career, I've cooked Italian food.
Yes.
So it's like, you have an Italian concept, like, why me? And we were just speaking and talking, and they said, if you were to open a restaurant, what would you want it to be?
Mm.
And I said, I would like a Mediterranean restaurant that really focused on Middle Eastern food.
Mm-hmm.
So at first, they were like a little taken aback by it, because I think
the Middle Eastern at that time. Like now it's a trend, people are saying. But I don't think so. I think it's just a way of eating healthy and exploring different cultures. Mm-hmm. So I came here and we started to do Mediterranean, taking a lot of influence from Italy, France, and Greece.
Yeah.
Probably the upper part of the Levant.
Uh-huh.
And then little by little, I was just sneaking in the turmeric and a little bit of coriander here and cardamom. And it was New Year's last year.
Yeah.
Not 2017. No, is that it? 2017.
The calendar had just turned over to 2017.
Yes.
Okay.
And we threw a party in here called the Night of Marrakesh.
Okay.
So I really told them, I want to do this blowout party. I don't want to do a prefix.
Yeah.
I want to make this place look like a souk. We hung a tapestry from the ceilings. Uh-huh. And we did this family style party with a belly dancer.
Yeah.
And Middle Eastern music.
Uh-huh.
And that was really the inception of Shuka. So for the next 7 months, we just toyed around with the idea. In July, we were just going to like close for a few days, do some aesthetic changes, and then open a Shuka.
Uh-huh. And your connection to this food is what? Why did you want to do this so badly?
I think, so I grew up, I live in Gravesend, where I grew up. My mother was born in Cobble Hill.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was born in a brownstone there called Strong Place.
Uh-huh, sure. I used to live right near there. Yeah.
We used to have Sunday dinner together.
Yeah.
That was just a tradition.
Yeah.
And on Saturday, we used to shop for Sunday dinner ingredients. There was like Sahadi's, which is obviously still there, Oriental, Tripoli.
Yes.
And on Saturdays, we used to go either for lunch or go to the little stores, Damascus, buy some pita. And we used to have this like little spread.
Yeah.
And it was something so new because we've never eaten like that before. Coming from an Indonesian background, I was familiar with spices. My dad was not shy with that as cooking while we were children. However, I just had really fond memories of it.
Yeah.
And I just wanted, every time I was off, I just would want to eat that kind of food. I think it's the variety of textures and flavors and colors that really just captivated me.
Well, it's funny. You mentioned that when you met Vicky and Mark, you said, you know, you guys already have an Italian restaurant. But yeah, I guess I hadn't even thought about it till you made that comment. But this style of food, when you said you don't think of it as a trend, it does to me, though, sort of dovetail with all these other things that people are drawn to at this point, I think, permanently in this country, right?
I hope so.
But a lot of this stuff is very simple. Like, Italian food is inherently simple, I think.
That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
It's to highlight a gorgeous ingredient using two or three things.
Yes.
And not overcomplicating it.
Yeah. And to me, I don't love the term California cuisine, but when people use that term or Cal-Italian, you know, when you think about the food that somebody like Justin Smiley does at Upland here in New York.
Yes.
Or what they used to do at Franny's, or that also is very simple food. It's great ingredients. It's not convoluted or tortured. And to me, this style of food that you do fits in that lane. It's not the same thing, but I think it has a lot of the same appeal to people. It's uncomplicated but delicious. No?
Yes, and I think that that's the way that the trend is maybe to eat.
Yeah.
And that's like being in season and being able to highlight these ingredients without, like, it's so funny because I think when you say like people, when I tell people that like this dish looks tortured, they're like, how is food tortured? But it can be.
You mean non-industry people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it can be. I mean, you look at a dish and you're just like,
I'm older than you. I was around for the 90s. I mean, this is nothing. But yeah. No, it can be, of course. But here's a question for you. So you, as a chef, right, how do you, with food that is that simple, how do you find the creative satisfaction that anybody who does something that is, to me, inherently creative at some level, or expressive anyway, right? How do you find satisfaction in doing this style of food? How do you walk the line between being true to the kind of source food and being who you are on the plate?
I think two things.
Yeah.
The first is, what did Chanel say? Like, before you leave your house, take off 5 items and that's your outfit. Totally butchering that.
Take off one thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think the idea is when I try to conceptualize a dish, we go through several iterations, obviously, before it even makes it to the menu.
Uh-huh.
And I think that sometimes, I'll tell you about this one dish. So
please.
These artichokes came in.
Yeah.
I was like, what am I going to do with these artichokes?
Yeah.
So fried artichokes came to my head because I guess it's from the Italian background. And I was like, artichokes, garlic, lemon. So we just started to play.
Yeah.
I was like, it needs something else. So we made a lemon yogurt.
Yeah.
And the artichokes come out of the fryer. They get hit with salt, fresh lemon juice, and raw garlic that's been basically pounded in a mortar and pestle.
Mm-hmm.
Sea salt, parsley.
Uh-huh.
So we started to make it. I added nuts to it. I put some salad on the bottom. And the more that I started to add to it, the more I realized it had nothing to do with artichokes.
Right.
So I started to undress it.
Right.
And it just got to a perfect place that it was perfect is a big word. But it got to a place that I was happy with.
Yeah.
And I felt like it did the artichoke justice.
Yeah.
And also kept away the vampires.
Uh-huh.
And I think the second part of your question is, with my menu here at Shuka, there are so many choices.
Yeah.
So I can have some dishes that have a little more cerebral work to them, if you will.
Yeah.
And then others that make sense just kind of on their own, basically very simply touched.
Uh-huh. You've done a lot of travel in your life. This is a passion of yours.
Definitely.
Can you just speak
I'm
to
kind
this?
Of itching in the chair right now. Usually in January I have something and
you're not getting away this month?
It was the busy season was insane. Okay. And I didn't plan for
the busy season being the holidays.
The holidays.
Yeah.
They just felt like forever.
Yeah. And now it's January. You didn't get away.
And now we're sitting
now
here.
Now we're less
Google.
Than a month from Valentine's Day.
Right.
You're not going anywhere.
I guess not.
And then it's going to be spring. So how does this has become almost a theme. I was speaking to someone at one of the sister restaurants of you guys. I was interviewing Hillary Sterling. The shows won't air a day apart, but I'm seeing you the day after I saw her at Vix. And I was saying that, you know, last season, this theme started to emerge of chefs and travel. And the comment I've been making, I made it for the first time to Michael White in his interview, and it came up with Curtis Stone in his interview, is every chef I know and every line cook I know, you know, people who make like no money, right? And they don't have the money to do this really. They have like 4 days or more off. They're out of here. They're going somewhere.
Absolutely.
Why is that?
It's a change of pace. It's the wanting, the yearning. You know, when you're being on top, and not I don't mean in the status wise, but as a chef, it's like a lonely place sometimes because it's not like you're complaining downward, right? You hope not to be complaining upward,
right?
But you need.
And in theory, you're not. In theory, you're not hanging with your staff the way maybe you did when you were like one of the people on the line.
Yeah, where you had like a place. I mean, we had a place outside of Avoce called the Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
Best nachos I've ever had.
Uh-huh.
And I can remember the conversations that started at 12 and ended at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
However, no, that's not happening. I'm getting older and it's a different life.
Yeah.
It's a different life. You really have to be on it and be a chef. Being hungover the next day is not fun. It's just
This talk with Tom Colicchio once where he told me that when he got to the point of being the chef, like it got lonely because he couldn't go out with his crew. And what happens to that part of your life, which for a lot of people draws you to the business? Or it's part of what it is. It's such a camaraderie.
It is. It is.
So.
But the travel aspect of it, it just opens up your – I mean, for me, it's definitely a change of pace.
Yeah.
Like, I get to get up at whatever time I want.
Yeah.
I get to leisurely do things.
Yes.
You know, of course, chef trips wind up eating at 37 places in 3 days.
Yeah.
But there's still – you're inspired. I think it's just a change of the normal daily routine.
Mm-hmm.
The hectic of the kitchen and the pressure.
Yeah.
And travel just opens. I mean, I just recently came back from Israel at the end of the summer, which I've never been. It was on my bucket list.
Yeah.
I was there for a little less than 2 weeks. And I feel like every day, my mind was blown by the most simplest of things.
Uh-huh.
And that connection, I had a dish there that was just sweet potatoes, a dollop of creme fraiche, and a pile of gray salt. It was done on this brown parchment paper that it was cooked in. It looked like an easy bake convection oven. It was like that perfect. The paper, it had like these, I'm not sure if they torched the paper. It looked like a pirate's map.
Yeah.
And I bit into the sweet potato, which I'm not even a fan of potatoes, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I know this sounds so ridiculous, but I got verklempt. Like, I felt like a tear. This was like the quintessential sweet potato.
Yeah.
And I think going back to what you were saying about the transparency of good food that doesn't need to be overdressed.
Yeah.
While I was there, I had so many dishes that were so super simple.
Yeah.
But so fresh.
Yeah.
In 96, I went to Italy for the first time and bit into a tomato and didn't even know what it was. It was like the juices were running down my face.
Yeah.
It was so sweet. It was vegetal. It tasted like the sun. It was so different than tomatoes that I've had here prior to then.
Yeah. That's amazing. Do you? Can I ask? You're not. Sure. Are you Jewish?
No,
you're not. I'm not. What made you want to go to Israel?
So I think it's one of those food. I mean, being in this, doing this food now.
Yeah.
I think it's part of like the Levant and like learning.
Yeah.
And I just know from a, like a, an angle of produce that they're just one of the best suppliers in the world.
Was it strange to? I mean, this. I've never been to Israel, but was it? Did you feel? I don't know. Did you feel there was a? Did you feel conspicuous not being Jewish there?
Yes and no. Yeah. I think in certain places, the religious ones. I mean, within the food touring, I definitely did some touristy things.
Like, uh-huh.
But I was traveling with a friend who actually got married there, and she had set us up with the tour guides, and it was just it felt very organic in a way. But
is this
definitely,
a Dana Sussman?
No, oh, okay. I wish. It's my friend Danielle Rehfeld.
Okay.
Who knows Adina. And if you're listening, Adina, I definitely want to meet you. So it made it like very organic. I mean, they took us to great places. I got to cook in someone's home, Kurdish food. I mean, we did minimal touristy things, but really a lot of things evolved around food, going to farms and milk the goat. I mean, we saw fields and fields of sunflower seeds at sunflowers, and it was just really breathtaking.
Yeah. You know, you and I just met last week. Mm-hmm. You and I are talking, well, we talked for a few minutes after lunch. The way you talk about food, you love food.
It's my longest lasting relationship.
But you really do. I've seen this once. I mean, this sounds like a weird thing. You'll know what I mean. I think there are a lot of people who are chefs who, as much as anything, they love cooking. That's not necessarily the same thing as loving food.
Right.
The way you're able to talk about something as simple and elemental as a sweet potato. Does this make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
You seem to.
I think it's an visceral thing.
You light up when you talk about it.
I think it's just. You know, it's hard to explain it. Now that you're explaining it to me, like I realize like how difficult it is to explain
flattery
to someone
will get you everywhere.
Someone else, because sometimes when I speak to my sous chef, she's like, okay. Like, I'm like, why are you not like,
right?
Why don't you look like this Christmas tree that I look like? Like, do you understand it?
So
I get, it's funny to see the adverse of that.
Well, it's striking. It is striking. I have seen this with people. You know, I just mentioned him, Michael White. To this day, I mean, I had the privilege of being in Italy with him when we were doing our cookbook.
That's awesome.
And I mean, it could be a piece of cheese, you know, and he was on cloud nine, absolutely on cloud nine. It's fun to be around.
Yeah.
I find it contagious. I mean, has it always been this way for you?
I think so. My friends would say it's annoying, not contagious.
What do you mean?
Every time we eat out, they're like, you have to get all of these things? And I'm like, yes, I do.
Do you try to make people try everything?
I do.
Like, do you have to share that experience with them? Like, try this.
No, I just want to make sure it's there, whether they eat it or not.
You don't care.
It's their discretion, no.
Okay.
I don't. But I think, I don't know, I love food. I do, all kinds of food. I love, but I think I hate to use this word, but the older, the more mature I get, maybe is that better? I'm having an age sensitivity week this week.
Oh, listen, I turned 50 last summer, so I get no sympathy here.
I think I appreciate the simpler things. Yeah. I think when I was a young cook and chef, I appreciated, like when I was eating out, like the composure of that dish.
Right.
Maybe like how they came up to put these things on a plate.
How did they do that? Right. How did they come up with that? Yeah.
And now I'm more impressed with like biting into a radish that has that spiciness and the zest of what like not a waterlogged one has. Does that make any sense?
For me, like when I was thinking about being a writer, and obviously I'm not putting myself in the realm of these people, but I remember I was on a flight home from college in New York back home to Miami end of my freshman year, and I read The Great Gatsby. And I was like, oh my God, I want to write like this. This is amazing. And then a couple years later, I was reading Hemingway, which is the most stripped down, you know, like opposite. And I was like, you know what? This guy's the genius. This guy's the genius, you know?
Yeah.
I relate to Fitzgerald as a personality and his life. I mean, I find his life fascinating more than I do Hemingway. But then when you read what Hemingway could do
just like in
a five-word sentence that was just, you know, perfect.
It knocks the wind out of
you. That's kind of a weird analogy, but that is what I think of when I think about that. Because for me as a writer, that was a revelation to me. I thought that, for me, I thought that was a sign of maturity, you know, to be able to recognize that.
And I think that
it's
is
harder
a sign,
too.
It is. It is a sign of maturity, like when cooking and coming up with dishes and menus and identifying your own cuisine. yeah. if you will. Or like, yeah, you know, sure. I'm not cooking someone else's food now. I'm cooking my food.
Mm-hmm.
So I think making your own identity
yeah.
in that and yeah. finding some type of stride.
Yeah. So talk to me. Can you talk to me about something you do that's relatively classic? And for you, what is makes it satisfying for you?
As far as dishes?
As far as cooking it. Yeah, something on the menu.
I think the lamb tagine right now uh-huh. is probably that. I had the opportunity to go to Morocco a few years ago,
yeah.
which was another amazing, amazing trip. And I cooked in this woman's apartment. She had 7 children.
Yes.
She was not on a respirator, but had she had like a, what do
an
you call
oxygen
that? An oxygen
tank,
thank you very much,
yeah.
tank. It was about 117 degrees. Okay. And they asked me to go to the market. With, you know, if I wanted to go to the market, I was of course. So
yeah.
I got dressed in the jahib.
Uh-huh.
And I walked the market. I had fresh goat's milk, which, and camel milk, which I yes. don't know that I would ever do again.
Yeah.
And we shopped, and then we went back to her apartment. And this woman made braised lamb over couscous.
Yeah.
On a propane tank in a very small apartment. And everything by hand. There was the language barrier was true. I had no idea. And she would just show me. And
she
then
was
I
just
would
demonstrating. When you say the propane tank, you mean like one of those little like portable burners?
Yes.
Like that you would use like in a demo?
In a camping site, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was about this big.
Yep.
About 10
it's
inches.
Like the size of a turntable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And she had a couscousier,
yeah.
which is the pot.
And the propane like snaps in on the side.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
I mean, cooks will know this is like some people have them in the kitchen right. in case like there's a problem or they need an extra prep.
But I've never seen that in someone's home.
Yeah.
Before.
Yeah. And I've never seen it in a home.
And she
yeah.
sat there. She had a very small table. It was like a folding table with a plastic mat on it.
Yeah.
And she showed me how to make couscous by hand.
Yeah.
I do not do that here at the restaurant.
Uh-huh.
But however, I have done it at home.
Yeah.
And then she showed me how to make this lamb. And it wasn't about quantities. It was about... She just knew at the right time when to season things.
Yeah.
There was no salt
yes.
in the beginning.
Yes.
She used the inside of the preserved lemon. This one sitting with this woman
yeah.
changed the way that I viewed, like, not Moroccan food, but how I was building braises.
Yeah.
So the inside of the preserved lemon, I've always discarded and just used the outside.
Uh-huh.
So the inside, they puree, and they use it as a salt and acidic element when
uh-huh.
doing braises. So she had the lamb on top of it, and it was just, I just have fond memories of her hands and how she was really showing me and tasting throughout and showing me like why it wasn't right.
Right.
Like she opened the meat and she was like pointing to, I guess it was not cooked, but we didn't know how to communicate
to each
other.
And this is just a home cook.
This was just a home cook.
Yeah.
And I think the lamb dish that's on the menu right now is really inspired by that experience. And
okay.
her.
That's amazing. Now, was the stuff she was doing, do you have any sense? Was it like her little trick or was this kind of how people do it around there?
I think it was just a generational thing. She
yeah.
said that she's been cooking for since she was a young
yeah.
girl. You know, they put one pan out. The
yeah.
whole family came.
Yeah.
There was like one glass of water.
Yes.
That was just passed around.
Yes.
And eating by hand.
Yeah.
And it was like just a beautiful thing. You know, I think we talk about the connection of food.
Yes.
But how it also connects people.
Yeah.
Is it and a totally another...
It's a huge part of the human experience,
yeah.
right? Forever.
Forever.
You know, this is the second country you just mentioned where you went and you didn't say I went and I staged in a restaurant or you went to someone's home. Is that your MO?
I think it is.
How did you come to that? That's not, I think for most chefs going on the road, that's like a special or, you know, it'll come up. Or they got invited to a dinner. It sounds like you seek these moments out.
So usually in August, my family takes a trip.
Yeah.
And my aunt has been traveling her whole life too. She's also a fan of it. And she's always went to like a cooking class.
Yes.
So we started to incorporate that as we were traveling to different places. And when we got to Morocco, we took a cooking class.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, but it was like there was no soul to it.
It's like a laboratory.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
made the same thing
yes.
over a little burner.
Yeah.
And I honestly can't remember. I remember chopping tomatoes and
yeah,
making
yeah.
some kind of like bread.
Yeah.
It was very tough.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the experience that I wanted. I wanted to see what the people really eat.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see how it really gets cooked, what it's like to walk the streets of the market.
Yeah.
You know, these women are sitting out with these small little blankets on the floor with sometimes it's just handfuls of produce that they're pulling from whatever garden
yeah.
that they might have trying to make money.
Right.
How the meat is hanging with no walk-in, no
uh-huh.
no refrigeration.
Yeah.
The live chickens that are walking 1 minute and the next minute they end up in a paper bag. the cooking of bread by this one baker. You know, everyone takes their, they make their own bread at home, mm-hmm. and then they take the bread on like a tray.
Yeah.
And usually you can tell by whose it is by the napkin or doily that they put on top yes. of the bread. It's like a family name.
Yeah.
And then he breaks the bread and it comes back and you pick it up and on your way out.
Yeah.
And this guy's in this pit making this bread all day long.
Yeah.
It was just really...
Do people... when you put yourself in these situations, I mean, you just described this woman with the oxygen tank right. and everything else. I hope she didn't get too close to the propane, by no. the way, with her oxygen
she,
tank.
She had a.
I'm a little
wires.
Worried about this woman.
She knew her wires.
But do people share a lot with you? You seem to be this curiosity, I would think. People, to me, and cook, professional or home cooks, respond to that.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Chefs, you would probably respond to that in a young cook.
Absolutely.
Yeah. An eager, you know, if someone seems eager to absorb information.
I feel like, you know, as a chef, you're yeah. always a teacher and a student.
Mm-hmm.
And I have all this knowledge to give. I would love to, like, cooks to be, you know, we're not talking about this, but it was different when I was a cook.
Yeah.
Like, if you wanted to really know things, you had to ask questions. You had to learn, take your own initiative. I worked at Felidia. Mm-hmm. For Fortunato, and there was a four burner stove in the kitchen, and he used to make like specials for VIP customers.
Yeah.
And as soon as he was done, I would run to that pot with my spoon and like just eat it and like run. He never told us what he did, like, or like showed us. It wasn't yeah. on the menu.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to learn. And I think that, you know, being open to wanting to learn and open to teaching
yes.
is like, there's just a wealth of knowledge there.
You have a good taste memory, I'm assuming.
I hope so.
And do you have a good, what would we call it? I guess like, do you have a forensic palate? Like, can you taste like what Fortuna did?
And
in your mind go, oh, I can, and sort of back into it?
For the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not always that successful with it. But
you get a sense you can maybe
the key ingredients
figure it out, trial and error.
Yep.
That's so interesting. How long ago was your last line cook gig before you came over to the kind of leadership side?
At least 10 years ago.
Okay.
I think.
And you feel like at that point you still had to really seek it out or ask for stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think at all times. I mean, I remember like even being a sous chef.
Mm-hmm.
Like you never stop. I don't know. I think your search for knowledge when it comes to cooking, it
yes.
just you just really have to seek it out. You just have to look for it. You have to... The more you know, the better it is for you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a cookbook hoarder.
Yeah.
And I read them like from cover to cover.
Yes.
And not so much the recipes and
yeah.
not so much the story sometimes. But
yeah.
just like the general knowledge of like, wow, how do you come to this dish? Or why would you choose this ingredient?
Yes.
And I find it fascinating.
Do you, what else do you do you mentioned cookbooks just now. How else as a relatively young chef, how else do you go about sourcing information? Like, do you still read actual print food magazines? Do you spend a lot of time on YouTube? Do you like where else do you go for information?
I think it's a combination. I think I'm a little old school. We were talking before about landline phones. I still have
uh-huh.
one. I do read a lot of print. I subscribe to Savoir, Food and Wine,
yes.
you name it.
Yeah.
Do I have the time? Sometimes I'm reading April's and July.
Yeah.
But online, some stuff.
Uh-huh.
I think YouTube, I could probably do more of it.
Yeah.
I don't know how to search. Does that make any sense? Like, that's not my key to search that.
Yeah.
I think when I go back to, like, oh, I'm thinking of something, maybe I think I have a pretty good memory.
Yeah.
And I'll remember, like, what book I saw it in,
yeah.
and I'll kind of read it that way.
Yeah.
I do some research online, but I'm not sure that YouTube is my primary source
yeah.
of it.
Well, no, I just wonder because there's so much, you know, you talk about old school. There was a time when it was cookbooks.
Right.
That was it.
I think that's really my biggest
reference
point.
And maybe some TV shows, but none, they weren't, you know, I mean, yes, you could get the basics from Julia Child.
Right.
But there wasn't what there is now. Now there's all these television shows. There's these biographical things like Chef's Table.
Right.
You can learn how to probably butcher, cure, sous vide, anything on YouTube. But there's still books and magazines and newspapers. So I'm always just curious
yeah.
where
I think
people go to as their default for information. Because you can't go to everything.
You can't. I think that if I have to say one thing, it'd be the cookbooks.
Still.
I have those little post-its where I'll just like post it
yeah.
like lemon pistachios
yeah.
or like, I don't know, carbonara.
Yeah.
Like a different way of doing it.
Publishing is losing altitude, right, as a business.
Rapidly, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But one of the areas that still holds up fairly well is the food realm. And I've always believed is because books are tactile. Like there is a there's something in common between books and cooking or books and food.
There is.
Which is that I don't want to overstate it, it's just paper, but it's essential for the eyes if there's photography, you know, or in the writing if there's, you know, the description. You want something that you can't really get, you know, on a tablet or a device, I think.
I agree.
I think something's lost in the translation.
I think it'd be more difficult to scroll up and down between a recipe than kind of have it on your book stand.
Sure.
And, I don't know, there's something authentic about that.
Yeah.
You know?
And like you said, being able to scribble in a margin or slap a post-it on it. And then your book, you know, books have character.
They do. And you could pass them down. I don't know. Yeah. There's something about them. Having the splatter of like making Marcello Hazan's bolognese for the first time.
Yes, right. You know? Yeah.
The crushing of the tomatoes by hand. And,
it's
know,
so funny you say that because I actually do. There are actually stains and splatters and things in some of my books. And I actually, 15 years later, I remember who I was cooking for. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of weird, but it's true.
It is true.
We are talking with Chef Aisha Nerjaya. We're at Shuka Restaurant. We'll be right back after this break. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Come for the food, stay for the friends. Fine Diners Over 40 is a members-only dinner club for singles and couples who enjoy dining at highly rated restaurants and sharing the experience with others. Fine Diners Over 40 appreciate food as art, as cultural adventure, as scientific experiment, and best of all, food as an opportunity to take pleasure in the company of others. Join them for culinary and social adventures in New York and Seattle. Food may be the main attraction at Fine Diners Over 40 events, but it is the friendly and interesting members who carry the day. Join them for an evening of fine dining, fun, and stimulating conversation. While enjoying innovative tasting menus by first-rate chefs, you'll talk movies, theater, pets, sports, travel, and more. Epicurus said it best. We should look for someone to eat and drink with before looking for something to eat and drink. Learn more at finediners40.com. That's finediners40.com. Better keep it at least
an arm's length away. Welcome back to the show. We're going to return to the rest of our interview with Aisha Nerjaya of Shuka Restaurant in just a minute. Before we do, though, Caitlin, I'm leaving you again. I'm going back on the road.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I did notice that on the calendar. And where are you going, Andrew?
Yes, we have a calendar on our fridge. That's how much I'm away promoting my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, the weekly plug. I am going to my hometown.
Miami.
Yeah. I think every writer, that's something you want to do. I didn't love Miami, if I'm honest, growing up. But Miami now is a vibrant, fun...
There's a
food festival there, the Food and Wine Festival every winter, which is like spring break for chefs. But I grew up in Coral Gables, Florida, and I'm going down. Now, when I was a kid, Norman Van Aken, most people listening to this show probably know that name. Norman is a legendary chef. He's in my book, and he's just the nicest. We're not close friends. I don't know Norman that well. We've had a little bit of a pen pal relationship over the years. We've met once or twice at James Beard Awards and stuff like that. But Norman's graciously giving me 2 days of his time at his new restaurant, which has a sort of cooking school event space attached to it, in the kitchen with Norman Van Aken on Wednesday, the 28th of March.
That's really
soon.
So that's
about a week from when this show drops. We're going to have a reception. We're going to do a little talk. I'll be signing books. He'll be signing his book. It's going to be fun. And then the next night, we're going to be at the Books and Books. That is a beloved bookstore chain down in Miami. Chains sounds too corporate. It's a beloved group of bookstores.
Can you say multi-location bookstores?
Even that sounds too corporate. It's just a beloved little group of bookstores. But the Coral Gables location, which is a bike ride away from where the house I grew up in, Norman and I will be there. He will be signing copies of his latest book. I will be signing copies of Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And we're going to talk. And I, you know, much as it was with Ruth Reichel and me and Santa Monica and David Waltuck and I were at the Philly Chef Conference together, I'm kind of loving, in particular, this format of me as someone writing about that era conversing with someone who was actually a participant in that era. And Norman very much was that. And, you know, he's best buds with Emeril Lagasse. He was super close friends with the late Charlie Trotter. He himself started right around the time the book really kicks into gear. So it's going to be a great dialogue, I think.
Sounds fun.
It's going to be great, both of those. So look for those. If you go to my website, tokeland.com, there is an appearances page, and you can see all the information there. There's links where you can click through to all this stuff. So that's happening next week.
Have a great trip.
Thank you. I also, in addition to my usual plugs, which is please, if you'd like to follow the show, at Chef Podcast is the handle on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you would leave us a review on the Apple's iTunes store where you can subscribe to the show, or even just a rating, which takes 2 seconds, it helps people find the show, and I'd really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to make an ask of our listeners, Caitlin.
Do it.
I told you I was going to do this. And you think it's okay?
I think it's totally fine.
If you guys like this show, it's a free show. I have this new book out. I spent 5 years on this book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. It is a history of the evolution of the chef profession in the United States from the early 70s through the early 90s. I would love for you guys to buy the book. I'm just going to put it out there just like that. If you enjoy this show, if you'd like to do something nice for the host.
I think it's more than doing something nice for you. It's a really great book, Andrew.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, if you listen to this show, I dare say you would enjoy
like
the book.
It.
It's gotten very nice reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love for you to buy the book. And I'd love for you to tell your, if you like it, I'd love for you to tell your friends. I'd love for you to post a picture of it on Instagram or Facebook. I'd love for you to review it on Amazon. I would love your support for this book. I'm just asking for it. I'm not going to do this every week, but it would mean a lot to me. I really want people to read this book. I am very proud of it. And this is what the author's life is like in an age with fewer newspapers and less places that cover books. And you just need to be this sort of shameless about it. So there you go.
Good job.
I'm going to leave it at that. Yeah. This is uncomfortable for me.
No. Okay, you can move on.
Okay. So that's it. With that, I am now going to return you all to the rest of my interview with Chef Aisha Nerjaya at Shuka Restaurant. Here you go. So Aisha, can you take me back, not necessarily to your culinary beginnings, but you grew up in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Can you just talk to me about what a Brooklyn childhood was like for you?
Sure. Unparalleled. I grew up where I still live in Gravesend, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And we lived on a block that had lots of kids,
uh-huh.
families,
yeah.
and lots of older people.
Uh-huh.
And
people who had come from other countries or
it was
a
primarily
lot of people,
Italian.
Primarily Italian.
But there
okay.
were some, but primarily Italian.
Yeah.
And my mother loves to tell the story that all the kids were outside playing. I think I must have been about 6.
Yes.
And they back then, I don't even know if they probably still have them, but they had lawn chairs then.
Uh-huh.
And all the older men used to sit like in someone's stoop with their lawn chairs in a circle smoking
yeah.
cigars.
Yeah.
And I would pull up my little lawn chair
yeah.
and let's listen to their stories.
Did
I
you?
I feel like there's so much to learn from, like, learning about, like, my grandma was born in 1921.
Yeah.
And she used to tell me these stories about, like, her childhood.
Yes.
And I was, like, so enthralled how, like, the horse and buggy, how they used to,
uh-huh.
just different things, you know, the first
yeah.
time the car or the television, how, what a big deal it was.
Yeah.
For
I
them.
Still remember my family, my mother grew up in Miami Beach, and I still remember the day they had one of the first air conditioned cars. This is in Florida.
Right.
And they told me the first time they got in the car, they were driving through Miami Beach with the windows up in the summer, and that people were pointing at them.
Right.
I probably heard that story 40 years ago. It's indelible.
It is.
Yeah.
And so my mother was Italian, my father Indonesian.
Yeah.
My mother was a teacher. Yeah. She's now a principal. And my dad, who's now passed, was a chef on a ship that transported liquid natural gas from America to Asian countries.
Amazing.
So he'd be home for 4 months and away
for a private company.
For a private company. Uh-huh. So for 4 months, we'd eat Italian food. And then 4 months, we'd eat Indonesian food. Yeah. And then therefore, now that's why I have an iron stomach.
Uh-huh. All right. But, that's funny.
There was a lot. We were really involved in the community. I went to private Catholic school.
Uh-huh.
So played sports with the church. My father's family used to have like outings in Prospect Park where people used to cook and hang out, playing badminton.
Yeah.
It was a very active childhood.
Do you, you know, you talk about a Brooklyn child. You talk about what you did, the lawn chairs. You know, people start thinking about like kids running through a fire hydrant on a hot summer day, like opening up the hydrant. That all seems highly exaggerated. It's not that exaggerated. Is what Brooklyn is like, and it was more even like that when you were growing up, yes?
The fire hydrant we might not have had.
Yeah.
I think we had sprinklers then,
uh-huh.
if I can remember correctly. But, yeah, we like the parents on the blackboard, a communal basketball court thing. We used to play in the street.
Yeah. Did you play stickball?
Stickball.
You did.
We used to play stoop ball when you had to put the blue ball on top of the stairs and you wanted to hit each one of them, football, skating.
Yeah.
Everything was outdoors. There was very limited TV. I remember, I think on Friday at 8 o'clock, we were allowed to watch Fraggle Rock for an hour.
Fraggle Rock.
But
for people who don't know, I believe that was a Muppet spinoff thing or something, or a Jim Henson thing. Yeah.
Which was like the old TV where you had like this little black box that you got HBO
and
from.
And that was your HBO.
That was your jam right
there. Yeah, that was your cable TV. So, and what kind of kid were you? Were you shy? Were you outgoing?
No,
were
definitely
you
not shy.
Ever?
Ever.
Okay.
Ever. Maybe now. No, I'm lying to you. Just outgoing. Yeah. Just rambunctious.
Yeah, rambunctious.
I think trouble? I was always one. No, not really. Just wanting to be involved in everything.
Yeah.
You know, I was never, I'm still not a sleeper. I just want to like go.
Do you suffer for that? Like, are you tired? Do you have to drink a ton of caffeine?
No. I think now I'm more tired than ever.
Yeah.
But I think it's a process of getting old and your body getting used to not being able to do the things that
to do. Sure.
But, always laughing.
Uh-huh.
I remember always being around friends and family.
Uh-huh.
Just, it was a really fun childhood, very adventurous.
Uh-huh. And when did you start, you mentioned you started to travel because of your, it was
my
your
family.
Aunt. Yeah, your family.
So we traveled often, definitely every year we take a trip.
Yeah.
I think when I got into my, probably like after college, we used to take like a big trip, like an international trip, if you will. But I was traveling at a very young age. I mean, my father was basically here by himself. His family was in Indonesia.
Yeah.
We would take trips there.
Yeah.
Most of my mother's family was here, so we never went to Italy together.
Right.
The first time I went with my friend to see her family.
Yeah.
And traveled a little bit.
It is interesting to me, you know, first of all, the two cultures that kind of flow through your family, and then being in Brooklyn at the time that you describe, you know, with the sort of, the way people are thrown together in Brooklyn, it does seem like where you ended up culinarily just kind of flows very naturally out of just your life.
Yeah,
it seems like
it. Yeah, I never looked at it that way, but for sure.
And also the fact that you're so comfortable jumping on a plane and going to places where you don't speak the language. And I mean, that to me also seems kind of a piece with what you were just describing.
Right. I think that I don't have that story. My grandmother definitely cooked. My mother cooked. I set the table and unset the table.
Yeah.
I don't think I washed any dishes.
You weren't just, like standing by on a chair in the kitchen, like, crimping the ravioli.
At all. The only thing that I definitely helped with is Christmas time. My grandmother used to make struffoli, those little honey balls.
Okay.
So they're like, it's a dough
that
you used to roll into small balls and fry and then doused in like this honey syrup and like little sprinkles.
Yes.
I used to give them when you used to visit people's homes.
Uh-huh.
We used to do that together.
So you would do that.
But other than that, I was a better eater than a cook.
And when did you start deciding I'm going to pursue this as a career?
So when I was in, I think, first grade, my mother was like 5 minutes late for picking me up from a bus. My brother was just born. So she's like running down the block with the newborn. And the next day, the school called her in and they said, we know that Aisha could walk and talk her way home. However, you have to be on time. And it was from then that my mother was like, you have the gift of gab. You're going to be an attorney. And I was like, oh, God. So going through school and all that, I did get accepted to law school, and I was working at a very prestigious law firm in Manhattan. And then
you started law school?
No, I was accepted.
Uh-huh.
But that September, I decided to go to culinary school instead.
So the summer prior to when you would have started law school, you were working at the firm?
I was working at the firm.
Were you like a – were you? Could you have even been a paralegal yet?
I was, but not a certified one, but I was doing the work.
You were sort of doing that – okay. You got there, you impressed people, and they started giving you more to do.
And they would
just – like a young cook.
Right.
Yeah.
And that thirst for knowledge. And I was working and on this like ridiculous case one day, and I was like, I'm going to leave for the day. And I went home. And people tell you to do what you love.
Right.
At the time, when I still have this piece of paper, I ripped it and I wrote with things that I love to do. And in this order, I wrote music, diamonds, and food.
Uh-huh.
So the next day, I went to the New York Gemology School.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to study diamonds.
Now, wait a minute. You jumped over music.
I jumped over music. I went right to the
Did you ever do anything with music?
Now I'm trying to take some private DJ lessons. I bought all the equipment.
Wow.
It's on the novice level.
You
maybe
take
a little
this
above.
On while you're running a restaurant.
I'm trying.
That is amazing.
The only thing I'm spinning is just basically one song over and over
right
now.
Yeah.
And but it took me 10, 15 years to even go back to the music thing.
But I'm sorry, yeah. I'm interrupting you.
No,
but
please.
Why didn't you go after the music? Why didn't you go after number one back then?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Did it just seem
like
too unattainable?
Well, I think that
too-
my number one, when I say music, wasn't that I wanted to be. I did take piano and flute lessons, and I played that through high school.
Uh-huh.
However, I wanted to be like the DJ in Vegas.
Got it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And I didn't know how to really pursue that. I guess my mind wasn't like thinking of like how to do that, and I figured like, let me skip to something that could be, I could probably like study like diamonds for 6 months and then be the biggest diamond dealer ever.
Yeah.
And I went to the New York Gemology School and the lady laughed at me, of course. And she was like, it doesn't work like that. You study gems. And I was like, I need like an expedited way of doing this.
Yes.
And then I walked to the Institute of Culinary Education when it was on 23rd and 6th Avenue.
Yeah, sure.
And I walked in there and I met with a woman named Linda Simon, who is a regular here at the restaurant. And she's
That's
visited
so
me
great.
All through my career
That's
and all
so
the restaurants.
Great. Guardian angel.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, I just had a feeling. You know, I always go with my gut. I try to, anyway.
So she took you in. You saw the people in the aprons and the
like,
toques and the kitchen, the stations, the teaching stations. And
it was like, this is it.
You
it
were
felt,
home.
It felt like I was 100% on 2 feet.
Yeah.
I was like, I want to do this. How do you sign me up?
Yeah.
So she's like, you can sign these papers. You know, you need to sign it for a loan. And I was like, I got to tell my mother.
Right.
And like, so I want to backtrack a little bit of why food was on there. I moved out when I was 19.
Out of your home?
Out of my home.
Okay.
Around the corner from my house.
Into what? Like roommates? What'd you have?
My best friend's – I still live there.
Okay.
My best friend's family had like a 3-family house.
Yeah.
And I moved into the basement apartment.
And you're still there?
I'm still there.
Oh, my gosh.
So I used to watch Lydia on television.
You are a creature of habit.
Yeah. Lydia on television from my mother's house and then from in high school and college.
Yeah.
I just watch her. And I was like obsessed. I cooked everything that she made. So I started to novicely cook then.
Yeah.
And when I first moved out, I didn't know really how to cook because I didn't take on all the lessons I could have learned throughout my family.
Yeah.
And I started to make the dishes and I wanted to be her. She was just like the grandma with all this knowledge. I didn't know then like what a fierce businesswoman she is.
Right.
But I knew that I wanted to work there. And I had eaten at Filidia a few times for special occasions. And then I went to culinary school.
Yeah.
And I worked in the law firm from 9 to 5, went to school from 6 to 10.
Yes.
And then I walked to Filidia and I walked in Filidia one day and I was like, I want to work here.
Yeah.
And they were like, what? You have no experience. You have nothing. I was like, I'll work for free. And they shunned me away 3 times.
Had anyone told you to do that? Or
No, I just did it on my own.
You were just being you.
And on the 4th time, I just walked in the hatch down the basement and I changed and I got a mop in my hand. And then I worked all the way from...
Well, you just did that without anyone having told you it was okay?
Yeah, they were like tired of me coming. It was like the same week.
That is
and there was
hilarious.
A sous chef there and he was like, if you want to mop, you can mop. And I was like, okay, can I peel carrots and mop? He's like, go ahead.
Do I not want to be on your bad side? You're describing, this is all very forceful stuff being put to very good use. And you have all these close friends, but can this be used for ill, like for harm?
Not anymore. I'm tired.
Not anymore. You used to be like that though, right?
A little bit.
I sense you would not be someone I would have wanted to like, you have a lot of energy to invest in.
Yes.
Wherever it needs to go. Okay.
Exactly. It has to be channeled.
And, got it. Okay.
That I graduated from culinary school. I worked at Felidia.
Yeah.
I was there for 3 years, became sous chef there, and that was really the start for me.
Amazing.
And my parents were extremely unhappy.
Because, well, your dad did that.
Yeah,
they wanted, you were going to be a lawyer.
Right.
Right.
They just wanted
something.
He was
working
better.
On a ship, and you were going to be in a high rise and have a big
office.
Big spanking apartment on the other side of the river, and
Yeah. And here I was in the black and white checkered pants.
And living in the basement around the corner.
Exactly.
Well, it turned out okay.
She's okay. They're okay now.
I have to go back, though, to this DJ thing. So I don't want to be too Freudian about it. But this is interesting to me that you thought about DJing, right? Because if you think about what a chef does, and if you think about the style of food that you operate, what does a DJ do? A DJ takes existing music.
Mm-hmm.
They combine it in a way that makes it uniquely theirs. They stand at their booth, and they watch all these people dancing and whatever to the thing that they've spun out of that. No pun intended. Well, I guess pun intended, right? That's what you do here.
Yeah.
Right? You kind of
That's incredible.
No?
Yeah, it is. I'm just, it's like you're schooling me right now.
No.
No.
But that's what, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it very specifically, this kind of operating in this traditional vein, but putting your own sort of mark on it, right? And
and then
you're surrounded by people enjoying it.
Right.
I mean, it is a form of that
in
a way. I don't know. I think it is.
I think it
is. That's not too precious?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. I think I just need to practice more.
I think it's great that you are doing the DJ. You know, there are some chefs who DJ. I don't know if she still does. April Bloomfield used to start every day DJing in her apartment.
Oh, really?
Years ago. Yeah. And amazingly, when he was a young, I still can't picture it, but Paul Liebrandt used to DJ around London and a little bit in Europe. I think in Germany. And I think he called himself the Kraken, the sea monster.
Oh, really?
I think, or Kraken. I can't remember. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah, Paul did that. Or
it's
so,
a good name, actually.
Or so he says. okay, so where are you in your evolution now in the evolution of this restaurant? What's like as you come in here every day, as you just came off the holidays, as you think about, you know, when you have time, limited time to reflect on it, and it still felt relatively knew the metamorphosis here, but where do you see things going here?
I'd like to see another shuka, a bigger one.
Really?
I do. I think that this is not a trend. I think people eating healthy,
mm-hmm.
when having a lot of different choices, and you know, the Middle Eastern thing is a part of it, but it's a bigger part of like the everyday lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, eating in season and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think it speaks to the masses.
Yeah.
I'd like to see another shuka. You know, I think it's. I'd like to maybe diversify a little bit. I'm not sure.
You mean in terms of what's on offer here, or
no? I'm saying like and maybe open up another something
a different
else,
concept,
a different
at,
concept
some
and,
right.
at some point.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'll go back to Italian or explore something else.
Yeah,
but I think that my love affair with food will never end.
Uh huh.
So it's kind
clearly
of like an open book of evolution.
Yeah. What else do you kind of? What else do you enjoy eating these days? What have you gotten beyond here in New York? Like beyond your travels, what's like kind of. What's got your attention right now as an eater?
As an eater.
Whether or not it's something you think you'll take anything from or do anything with, just what
I'm
kind of...
I'm trying to think. You know what? It's so funny to say. It's so not on trends, but I really could care less.
Yeah.
I've been going to steakhouses recently.
Yeah.
And I just find myself super satisfied. It's like almost like a
where?
No-brainer. So I ate Keen's, of course.
Keen's. I don't know how many people outside of New York know Keen's. A lot of chefs love Keen's.
I mean, Keen's is just on point.
Yeah, Keen's is like spitting distance from Penn Station.
Right.
It is a truly old New York steakhouse.
It is.
It's an institution, and it is almost like hopping into a time machine when you walk in there.
I think there's something to be part of it.
Yeah,
you know?
It is.
And talking about creature of habit, I think my order is always the same. I start with a Kettle One dirty martini, not too dirty.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, the mutton chop is also always the highlight.
Yeah.
But depending on how many people are there, it's like a share and, you know, I don't know. I feel very satisfied when I leave that.
Yeah.
Not to say that I don't feel that way in different restaurants, but every time you eat out, it's a crapshoot, either on the good or the bad, or you know, there's a lot of times you can go for a fancy tasting menu, and then 3 hours later you're at a pub having a burger, and a beer.
Yes.
So not that that's not a good thing, but we've all, you know,
I won't name it. I did once go to a dinner. It was a place that was really hot, and my two friends and I afterwards went out and we went to Otto Pizzeria at the time and had a full
dinner, an entire second dinner.
I believe it.
And I remember being at a dinner with a bunch of chefs in Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and someone was saying how unsatisfying the meal was. And I said, did you go for another dinner afterwards? And all the chefs just burst out laughing. Yeah. I guess everyone's had that moment. It's pretty crazy. But you can also, I think, sometimes want to do that, even if you're not still starving, if the food you had was just soulless and you kind of need to be satisfied on that level.
It's true.
Right?
Pizza's always a good...
pizza, pasta, something.
Touching food.
Yeah. But steakhouse, again, that seems right in your lane to me. That's very, it's traditional.
I've been going to the old ones, Gallagher's, Smith & Wolinski.
Yeah.
I mean, my time is very limited, so if I go one a month, it's just still, I appreciate the grandness and the tradition of it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and I
never stray. Like, I don't eat, I don't get the special. I'm not eating fish there. Yeah. I'm not into surf and turf.
Yeah.
You know, the big boy meat.
Do you tell people you're a chef when you go into a restaurant cold? Never.
Never.
Is that because it's just not your style? Is that because you like to see what the full normal experience is? I've stopped IDing myself to people when I go into a restaurant if they don't know me. Part of the reason is I don't want to eat any more than I'm ordering. But part of the reason is that I'm not a critic, but I'm curious. I want to know what you can get very nearsighted if you're in the industry, I think. And I want to actually know what normal, quote unquote, normal people experience when they walk into a place.
I think it's not my style.
Yeah.
But I also think that that's my time when I'm eating out to be me. And what I enjoy, which I feel that that people now have detached themselves of, is in really enjoying eating out.
Yes.
Enjoying the company that you're with.
Yes.
Breaking bread together.
Yeah.
Talking about your day.
Yeah.
Not saying, oh, I can make this better. Yes. Or I had this somewhere else. And this is overcooked.
Yeah.
Or the new favorite that I love. It was meh.
Yeah.
M-E-8. What is that? Who said that that's okay
that
to say?
I don't know where that came from. Yeah. Right?
Anyway.
Yeah.
So I just want to eat. I want to have laughs. I want to have a good time. Yeah. I want to elongate it. I have no problem sitting at a table for 5 hours.
Yes.
Turning cocktails into wine, back into cocktails, into after dinner drinks.
Yeah.
The beauty of eating out to me is almost as precious as like my love affair with food.
Yeah.
That thing about enjoying being in company over a meal. There's something to be said about that.
Right.
And I feel that it's just people don't understand that.
No. They so if you go in somewhere and you identify yourself as a colleague or as that changes immediately, that changes everything.
It's a different thing. You know, I don't want to critique someone else's food. Listen, if it needs salt, I'll ask for salt.
Right.
You know, did the guy have a bad day? Maybe.
Yeah.
It is what it is. As long as I feel satisfied.
Yeah.
And I feel like sometimes you can find that in many things. It doesn't have to be this one dish that ruins your entire meal.
Of course.
You know, people review things now, they give it 3.5 stars. Like, who are you giving 3.5 stars to? It's like so...
What do you mean? I don't understand. What do you mean
by
that?
I'm saying like people that write on Yelp.
Yeah. On Yelp.
Yeah, and things like that.
Okay.
Like, just eat out. Have a good time.
Right.
If you didn't like it, don't go back. It's all good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I don't understand. I've never written a Yelp review in my life. I've been tempted once or twice. To be honest, that part of the, you know, the getting on the bad side part, it does happen, but I've not gone to the dark side.
But I also think like if you're in the restaurant, you don't like something, like say it.
Yes.
Let someone rectify it there.
You know what? Let's just say to listeners, this is a big thing. Nothing makes chefs, restaurateurs crazier than, well, first of all, seeing it on Yelp after the fact or the equivalent of Yelp. But second of all, even getting an email where it's private, anyone who's in the business for the right reason, they all want to know in real time so they can fix it.
Listen,
they want you to be happy.
No one comes to work to do a bad job.
Right.
We're here in the hospitality industry. I'm downstairs with the cooks. We want to provide you with the best dinner that you're going to have.
You want the people,
the best service.
Right. You want those people dancing, right? To go back to the DJ analogy.
And, and that's the beauty in it.
Yeah.
So why go home and dance to the song and then say you hated it?
Yeah, it's
you know. People, let us change the music here.
I just think I think part of that is on the industry, not you guys, but part of that's on the industry because people don't want to get attitude back, you know. And that does happen at places. But I think a lot of it is just like there is this dysfunctional mode of communication now where people can do that, and it doesn't do anybody any good. doesn't do anybody any good. Yeah. But anyway, I'm not here to lecture people. But yes, if you're having a bad time in a restaurant, tell somebody. Give them
a
chance
to fix it. We're more than happy to be here to fix it.
They want
you
to be happy.
We do.
Well, Aisha, it was great to meet you.
Likewise.
And getting to know you a little bit. And I guess that's it for now.
Okay.
But great chatting with
you. Thank
you. Thank you. And that's our show. And Caitlin, we did everything in one take today, so you're still here.
I'm still here. And I just want to tell people to, one, buy your book, but two, go to Shuka.
In that order. Sorry,
yeah,
Aisha,
order.
But in that order. Listen.
You can go to Shuka while you're reading the book.
Okay, so people need to know. First of all, we usually, you're always like, you're laughing right now. When we do these intros, it's just like a chore for you. You have a very busy life. You have your own professional problems. I don't do anything for you for your job. You hate this.
No, I don't hate it
you
at all.
You kind of hate it. You put a good face on it.
I don't hate it. And I also love talking about the place that I really love to go to.
Okay. So maybe that's how... Maybe I'll let you pick the subjects from now on.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you, Caitlin, for co-hosting the show and for doing such a convincing impression that you enjoy it.
I enjoy it, Andrew. I'm not... Sorry, I can stop.
She's literally getting out of her chair to leave. You know, when on a talk show sometimes when they go to commercial and the guests, you know, they're supposed to sit there until the camera's off, but they start to get up. That's kind of like what you, that's you when we do these interviews. But you sound like you want to be here. That's something I appreciate.
Thank you, honey.
Okay. Thank you, David Tatasciore, our engineer, for splicing these things together. I know it keeps getting more complicated, David. I moved all the plugs to the middle of the show. I think that's better for listeners, so it's more work for David. Thank you, David. Thank you, Heritage Network. Thank you to all of you for listening. And we will see you back here next week, if not sooner, on Andrew Talks to Chefs.